Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to this session, session number 9 on individualism. And it's such an important topic that we required 2 sessions on it. Last time, just to recap, we discussed what individualism was. Who remembers what individualism, how can it be defined, and what is it that differentiates individualism from, say, collectivism? Who remembers this?
The individual believes that they're the master of themselves, and they own themselves, basically.
So that's good. So these are some of the presuppositions of individualism, self-ownership, right? So let me ask you, though. What differentiates individualism, say, from collectivism?
The individualist is more, he advocates self-reliance.
Yes.
And self-interest, and his nuclear family, himself and his nuclear family's interests above the collective, above the rest of the population.
Right, so this is a good point. So the individual is prioritizing analysis above and beyond any collective grouping. Yeah. The family would actually be considered a group, a collective, the smallest type of collective that you can imagine. So individualism is even more atomistic, if you like, than to suggest a family unit construction. But absolutely, so the point you made was correct, which is that the main point here is that priority is given to the individual as a unit of analysis to the collective. And this is the most famous type of debate now we're having in modern time, which is that the debate, so-called debate, between individualism and collectivism. Now, we discussed that there were different types of individualism. Who remembers what kind of individualism... What types of individualism there were?
There was a methodological individualism.
Yes.
So here, it just kind of talks about what the individual does, it kind of just looks at the individual and says these are the priorities that an individual has, as opposed to ethical individualism, which looks at what the individual should be doing based on their kind of priorities, self-interest.
Right, so it's more descriptive than it is prescriptive.
Yeah.
Methodological individualism is a description of how society functions rather than, say, a prescription. And we have to think about what differentiates, and we've covered this a few times here, but this will keep coming up, and I think it's very important that we identify what differentiates a description of society from what can be referred to as normative ethics. Or teleological ethics, or say a consequentialist ethic, whatever it may be. Yeah, how do we know if something is now become moral? From a description, from an is to an ought, and this kind of almost solves the question. How do we know when the movement has been made?
When these words like should.
Right, so when words like should, good, bad, so these are moralizing terms. This is where individualism, in our case here, right, moves from methodological individualism to, say, ethical individualism of some sorts. It could be liberal individualism. What else could it be? What other kinds of marriages, ideological marriages, are made with individualism and other ideologies that we discovered last time?
So, like, liberalism and then anarchy.
Right, great. So, we said there was a kind of spectrum, and that individualism fits in to the spectrum. So, like, for example, a very famous type of individualism today is liberal individualism, not least because liberalism is the dominant ethic. Okay, and if you go more, let's say, to the right, if you like, of the spectrum, the furthest you can go is anarchism, because now you have no social contract, or now you have no government, now you have no dominant authority that's in charge of you. So that is on one side of the spectrum. But you also have different types, different. Anything else we've spoke about that you remember from your notes?
We kind of talked about how individualism wouldn't be is inconsistent with a deterministic.
Oh, we're jumping now.
Okay,
a little bit.
Jumping.
Yeah,
okay.
We're just saying what kinds of individualism are there?
Okay.
So think about the three big things. We talk about politics. We talk about something, or we're talking about something else? No.
Is it political?
Yes.
Is political is connected to liberalism, economic is connected to capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely on the right tracks, but what you're right there, because what I was trying to say was the tripartite kind of classification that we usually have is we have political, economic, and what? Social, right? So individualism can be social individualism, it can be economic individualism, it can be political individualism. Okay? And so when we talk about individualism in respect to the economy, we're talking about how an individual actor operates, i.e., in the methodological individualism, and or should operate within the state, within the apparatus of an economy, a supply side economy. Whereas if we're talking about political individualism, now we're speaking about how an individual actor acts in, or acts and or should act in the political environment. And same thing with social, right? So just remember, individualism is not a standalone ideology. It can easily be married to other ideologies that are out there, you know. And we spoke about some of those. Now, today, what we are going to speak about, because we also spoke about last time, we spoke about what Islam, the Islamic system, and we talked about how there are aspects of the Islamic system which are more collectivist, and there are aspects of the Islamic system which are more individualist, in the sense that the unit of analysis is one person, eschatological aspects that on the Day of Judgment will come as individuals, not as collectives. You know, that the collective will not really matter on the Day of Judgment, for example. We talked even about jurisprudentially, you know, how sometimes the individual can be favored over and above the collective in certain scenarios which we mentioned in Usul. Who remembers the scenarios that we talked about?
Well, the boat scenario.
Yeah, so Al-Ghazali mentioned what? Tell me what the scenario is.
There's three people on the boat, and then if one person were to jump off to save the other two.
Not jump off, but the other two to do what?
To kill. Throw him over.
Yeah. So what did Ghazali say?
This is not permissible.
Why not?
Because he doesn't fulfill the three categories.
Yeah, what are the three category criteria?
Kulli.
Yeah, which means?
For applicable for everyone.
Right? Yeah. So it's in the collective.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else?
Taruri.
Which means?
Necessary.
Right.
And the last one was Qat'i.
Oh, okay. Good. Which means?
Like, certain.
It's sure to happen. We can argue that, is there anything, is there any such thing as Qat'i? Al-Razi, who's obviously interested, I don't want to go into details, but Al-Razi's father didn't put Ghazali in the book of Asha'ira. He has a book called Tabaqat al-Asha'ira. He didn't put his name in it, but obviously Al-Razi was a fellow Ash'ari to Al-Ghazali. He says there's no such thing as Qat'i. Everything is ghalibu dhan. Everything, even the existence of God is. Which means, he says everything is ghalibu dhan, which means that everything is just hyperbole. That's the maximum you can get. So, you know, you could argue this is a very difficult statement, obviously. We don't want to go into details here, but the point is for practical purposes, if something has a very, very high possibility, then this is what I'm guessing what the Usulis will be referring to as yaqini here. Something that's over 95%, say. But even that is difficult to estimate. So if it doesn't fulfill these three criterion, then you can't say it's possible. And so therefore, sometimes the individual interest will be prioritized over and above what? The collective interest. Even in cases to do with jurisprudence. So we talked about situations where the individual interest can be. And we gave another example, which is a striking example. Say, for example, you have a group of people, five men, and some guy with a gun says, look, you've got a young two-year-old here. Either you gang rape her, or one of you rapes her, or we're going to kill all of you. Are they allowed to do that to her? No. So her interest is prioritized over theirs, because in this case, her ard, or her honor, is something you cannot trespass. And there's no situation in which you can trespass it.
Will terminate the entire community, so it is kulli, if you don't rape the child.
You can't rape the child.
Really?
Yeah. Even if it's kulli, in this case. But yeah, so this there are some things in Islam you just never can do, and that's one of them. The point, this is not me saying this, I mean, these examples are actually fleshed out. And this goes back to our lesson on what, if you remember, deontological versus consequentialism. Sometimes we do think about consequentialism, sometimes we don't. We think about deontological, like this is never, you know, you can never do this. All right, so today we're going to be speaking about the criticisms of individualism. We did a bit of that last lesson, but we're going to flesh them out. These are not my criticisms. These are criticisms that have been written by some of the main proponents, funny enough, of liberalism, of conservatism, of Marxism. Marx himself is in this list. And so what we're going to be doing is we're simply going to be looking at some of the main criticisms and discussing them. Okay, some of them are stronger than others, but that's simply today's lesson. We're going to be looking at, we're going to be fleshing out more what the criticisms are. So I'm going to go with the first one. This is a book that is called The Myth of Individualism, written by Peter L. Calero. Okay, now he introduces a murderous character. Now we're going to find it hard to pronounce his name. Who knows how to pronounce his name? Kaczynski. Is that right? Okay, so Kaczynski, this is a murderous character, has done all these bad things, yeah? And basically he concludes by saying that he has an extreme commitment to individualism. And this is the reason why. His intentional avoidance of personal relationships. You can go and see the story anyway, but ask yourself, are these features of societies which you think are individualistic? Number one, an intentional avoidance of personal relationships. And I want you to think about Japan here. I'm not sure if you know about Japan. Japan is, if you know Tokyo, it's a mega city, but the biggest city in the world in terms of population, yeah? And I'm not sure if you know this. There's a phenomenon in Japan where people are, like, renting out friends. Have you heard of this?
Yeah.
Because they're so lonely, they live in these kind of cubicle boxes that they're renting and they have friends that they used to come over and you pay them for the day so you can spend time with them. Because we're social creatures, right? Well, at least psychologically, we are told that we're social creatures. And if you don't give yourself a social environment to speak to people and to give and take and all this kind of thing, you're going to go mad. So this is a market opportunity. Obviously, Japan is one of the biggest market economies in the world. So they saw it and they said, we can rent a friend. Obviously, now we have, you rent boyfriends and girlfriends, yeah, escorts. This is a kind of, do you think that women and men that buy escorts or, well, sorry, not buy them, but rent them out, whatever the phraseology is, use escorts. Do you think they're only doing it? Do you think that the only reason they're doing it is because of sexual need? Maybe it is. Maybe that's a huge part of it. Maybe 80%. But I think that, if I were to do some study, which I don't think has been done before, I would also realize that a lot of people that use them are doing it because they're in extreme states of loneliness. They just want someone to sit there and talk with them. It's a very similar thing. We talk about Japan as if some alien culture. We have it right here in our doorstep in the form of escorts. You come, what does escort do? What does escort? What do they do? What's your job? I'm sitting here to speak to this person. And obviously do some other services if they want me to do them. Anyway, think about that. So, intentional avoidance of personal relationships. Why? Because is there facilitation for personal relationships? Or is it, like going back to the Japan example, you're living in these little cubicles. There was a show that was done a long time ago. It was called Megacities by Andrew Marr. Andrew Marr, the guy, a BBC guy, very deep voice. He had some controversy surrounding him recently. And he went to Dhaka. You know Dhaka, right? You're from it. You're from Dhaka. Are you from the Sylhet? Dhaka, but from Bangladesh. Right. So he went to Dhaka, yeah? And he kind of hanging around in the shanty towns in Dhaka. And then he went to Tokyo, and he was hanging around with people in Tokyo. And he said something in that documentary that I will not forget. He said something to the effect of, I'd rather be in Bangladesh than here. They have, as I'm paraphrasing, I don't want to, something to the effect of, they have more of a community spirit. This is like the most atomized society I've ever been in, etc., etc. Why would you want to, even though the prosperity levels are very much higher, obviously, in Japan than they are in Bangladesh, in terms of, like, material. But then the question is, would you really want to live like that, in a little box, calling a friend to pay them to come to see you? You don't have that community. A community, therefore, that doesn't have community as its priority, what kind of society is that? You've got to ask, So the second thing is, it's deliberate physical separation from others. This happens, people physically separate from others. The question is, is this because of individualism? Is it because they think it's all because of, it's, are people intentionally, let's bring this to society, do you think that people are intentionally trying to separate from other people? Very simple question. It's not really difficult, right? The third thing is the belief that he could live out his life completely independent of a larger community. The idea that actually I don't need friends, I don't need. And we hear this a lot in relationships, independence in relationships. You know, I don't need a man, I don't need this, I can eat, I don't mind eating alone, or, you know, this kind of nonsense, rubbish talk. What do you mean you don't need a man? What do you mean you don't need a relationship? That's not how you're built, man or woman. You know, I don't need this, I can do it all by myself. This isolationist discourse. But, once again, to what extent do you think this is prominent in the West over and above other nations, other communities, other cultures? His solitary development of a personal program of social reform, and number five, his strategy to unilaterally impose his ideas through a series of private acts that destroyed the lives of others. And this goes back to egoism. We spoke about egoism. You don't care about other people. You care about yourself. And individualism and egoism are very closely linked. We said they're not the same thing. But ethical egoism and individualism, like, there's a fine line that separates the two. Now, he then states, freedom of choice and self-determination are virtuous principles, but when selfish individual interests threaten to destroy the common good, the limits of individualism are exposed. Now, I want you to think about this, these four or five points with the person next to you, 4 or 5 minutes. And I want you to answer just one question. To what extent do you think this applies to, say, Great Britain or the United States? If you can generalize the Western culture, Western Europe and its extensions. To what extent are these criticisms, do you think they're valid from your own kind of experience, from your own, you know, interactions in the West, your own upbringing here? And we've got people that lived in different parts of the world. You lived in Spain. You've lived, obviously, in... okay, that's not the West part. But an outsider's perspective, that's actually quite good. It's very important. And then the rest of obviously, the UK. So 5 minutes and come back, yeah? All right, let's get some contributions from the people here. Who's going to start us up?
So for number one, me and Tariq, we got for personal avoidance of relationship, seeing the fact that even people are deciding to move to mega cities for the sake of opportunity and for the sake of, you know, developing their own, you know, pocket, and not moving for the sake of, you know, maybe finding, you know, a community or, yeah, a better community where they're able to connect with more people. That was one. An example could be, even when you go in the underground, my personal experience, and Tariq, I think he can agree with me, yeah, going to the underground, the lack of manners from people, lack of thank you, excuse me, or even a hello. I'm not there to make friends, but the fact that they're being so... the fact that they're being so rude, and even in some examples quite aggressive, comes to show that they're totally not interested in making relationships and avoiding it.
No, I actually see exactly what he's talking about. No, it's very odd. It's very odd. It's actually weird behavior. I think it's sociologically weird behavior. Like, a lot of the time where you're sitting with someone, the way that people just want to avoid communication in this country compared to other countries is I don't know. Who here has felt like that's something that's, you know, that is the case? Think of any country you guys are from.
I've got a lot of friends who come here from, say, Southern Europe, and they have you know, when they see people quiet in the buses and trains, they get, you know, anxiety because of that. So it's definitely not. I think this is more a Northern European problem than it is a Southern European problem.
Yeah.
People in Greece, Italy, and Spain, they're not like this.
They're out speaking, talking. I haven't been to Italy or Spain, but I've been to Portugal. And I just see them outside eating. It's a little bit more like North Africa. You know, I don't know. What do you guys think?
I was going to say also, I think it's just a London thing, or even with big city, like even New York, I've seen YouTube. I was living outside of London for a bit, and I was walking, and someone would say to you, good morning. Yeah. It's a salutation. You don't get a salutation. We get told about this, what happens in Muslim countries, but it does happen outside of London, where people move for the sake of having more land and having a better community. Not here.
There are some Muslim countries like this. I don't know about you. Tell me about the subcontinent, because I'll be honest with you. I'm going to tell you, share an experience with me. This is maybe going a bit off script here, but sometimes when I go into a mosque, and it's like a Bengali mosque, actually, you should help
it's
as well.
It's dead, isn't it?
You say Assalamu alaikum, and no one's saying Alaikum Assalam. What's going on there, bro?
Yeah, that happens a lot.
I don't think that's because of individualism. I think that's more because of like nationalism and because you're foreign. Like,
do you think that's what it is?
It's not individualism.
How do you know I'm not Bengali? More or less?
Bro, you don't look Bengali.
Well, is it the size or is it what gives away?
I don't think it's a Bengali thing.
No, but if you look Bengali, they would approach you.
Really?
Yeah.
No,
it is.
Not from my experience. Like, I'm Bengali, but they would atomize me from everyone else.
Where did that come from?
I think it's young people. Because all the olders have that kind of thing where they always want you to talk to them. And even if you do, they'll give you like a dead reply. They'll be like, I wouldn't really give you when I go to a Somali mosque, for example, like I'll go to Hayes and study. It's very like, the vibe is just a lot different. They're more lively. They always greet you, be more welcoming and stuff. That's just what I've experienced.
But, you know, tell us about Africa. Tell us about sub-Saharan Africa.
Got myself.
Yeah, have you been there?
Yeah, I've been there.
Okay, and tell me, like, compare your interactions with in people. Sub-Saharan Africa.
So when we went, this was like 2 years ago, we're walking in the village where, like, my father grew up and stuff, yeah. And, like, obviously my father, like, he goes back and forth, but since he moved to the UK. This is Uganda, yeah? So he left 20 years ago, but, it was really strange because you're walking down the street and they ask you, like, what's your surname, yeah? Like, they know my surname and they know who like my dad is and his grandfather is, and everyone's like saying hello and people are like, you know, oh, you guys are back, they give you like food and stuff, and it's like it's a vibe. And you go to the masjid and like everybody's like saying Assalamu alaikum, and after the salah, like, you know, like you hear like it's like an explosion of noise, everyone's like hugging, and it's not like it's like it's Eid, but it's not, like it's just like a random
like that deep, like with going on the train and not receiving not the appropriate you, salutation. Like,
you know. But like on that point about London though, yeah, because we were talking a bit about this, like especially when you go like central London, like in these companies and stuff like that, there's people who are like they're willing to backstab whoever it is, like it's like a competition,
yeah, yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
so like they're trying to get to the top of a company. They don't care about making friends. Like if you're close to them, it's just until you stop being useful, then they throw you to the side, isn't it?
I'll tell you a story actually on this point. I used to work. I'm not going to mention the name of the company, but I used to work as in a financial advisory firm. Okay, and basically it was like 97% white. It was a white company. There was like two black people and one Scottish guy who considered himself an outsider. Ginger as well, yeah. So I don't even consider him as part of the 97%, yeah. And I think one Asian guy. But, you know, anyway, I'm not going to say anything about him. But, so this is the thing. I was working. I was young, in my early 20s. And, you know, what it is that you have to build up, and then they give you an exam. It's a financial, like, it's FSA exam, so that you become qualified to give financial advice and stuff like that. So I had my bosses and stuff, and this was a dog-eat-dog environment. And for those who know me, I'm quite a confrontationalist sometimes, you know. I was quite aggressive in getting sales for them and, you know, helping them out and whatever. But then, after a few weeks, I was considering, you know, promotion and, you know, considering, you know, all these things. I started speaking to them and say, "What this, you know, this Scottish guy's been here for some time. How long has he been here? For 2 years?" And he's in my same position as me, which is like the entry guy, you know, before. So I spoke to one of the bosses. I said, "When do you reckon you'll promote him?" He looked at me and started sniggering. He said, "Promote him?" I said, "No, this guy's not going to be promoted." You know, kind of thing, you know. I said, if that's what you're saying about him, I was thinking about what you think about me. You know, it's... So the point of the matter is, what I realized in that environment, this is a corporate environment in Liverpool Street, like, you know, central London. And I've been there for years, actually. My first occupational thing was working there. Absolutely, bro. It's cutthroat environment. Cutthroat environment. And everyone's trying to finish everyone off. It genuinely feels like a Royal Rumble. You know, WWF Royal Rumble. We're trying to throw each other off and this and that. And that, okay, this is true. But does that represent the whole of the West? No. We can't extrapolate that outward to the cities and the towns and whatever. That is genuinely an environment where it's dog eat dog and maybe individualism at its worst. Right, but to what extent can that kind of thing be generalized, do you think?
Even as a corporate specific thing, because I work like in a lab.
You tell me.
Okay, I work like in a lab,
right?
It's a cancer research center. Okay. So everyone there works, like, it's majority white as well, I'd say. Like, I'm not like the only Asian person there, but they're more, a lot team based.
You work in IT there, or?
No, I work in the lab as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Work in the lab.
Go ahead.
Yeah, but it's more of a thing where everyone has their own role. Everyone helps each other.
I think this is work, a different environment. You know, cancer research. If there's atomism going on there, there's no sense of teamwork. I'd have no hope for the West. But, you know, yeah, I think it's a little bit different. You know, when everyone's trying to compete for commission or whatever it is that they're trying to compete in the corporate environment in the cities, I think it's definitely a little bit different. But let me tell you something, right? And this, once again, this personal experience and whatever, they're very important to us. I went to my mom's house recently, you know, and outside, obviously, there's her neighbors and stuff. One of the houses, police were coming to the door. I was saying, what's going on here? Police, like two, three police officers came into the door and stuff like that, and opening the door and stuff like this. And what I was being told was that they're opening the door because she has not been visited by anybody for 2-3 weeks, and we haven't heard from the woman for 2-3 weeks, and she's an elderly woman. So they thought I don't know, I actually don't even know if she had died or not, whether they found out that she had died in the house or not. But the extent to which she's been neglected, like the care homes for elderly people in the society, the people in there, is that something you can expect? Do you imagine that in some areas of the world? And no chance, this is very unusual. This is very unusual. Like, you ask somebody in Sub-Saharan Africa and Asia, I don't know, you tell me, in Sri Lanka. Do you have that in Sri Lanka?
No, not really. People fight over actually looking after their parents.
There you have it. Yeah. They have it, bro. It's very, very, very unusual. And the West has shrugged its shoulders to it. I don't know. These kinds of examples are very clear. Because obviously the COVID pandemic, I think, has exposed the situation even more. Like, it's really exposed the situation. Like, to the extent to which elderly populations are being disregarded in... But is this a byproduct of individualism? It's like, I've got nothing to do with them. I've got my thing, and they're doing their thing. It's not like, oh, they've looked after me, I have to look after them. There's no sense of family obligation, as you would in other places, other cultures.
I think people are starting to notice it. And so we're talking about this, it's quite ironic here, because you know a lot of, especially on like, say, like the right side of politics, like they'll talk about, oh, we're losing like our community character and all that kind of stuff. And what they'll do is they'll point the finger at migrant communities. And they say that it's because of the migrants, it's because of them that we've lost that kind of community spirit. But if you look within migrant communities, though, yeah, people who still kind of have that ethic within themselves that, you know, like you have to take care of your parents and that kind of thing, they don't have an issue with that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you want to point the finger at migrants for things that, you know, are really coming from like the philosophy that's like sort of become prevalent within the land, which is a culture of taking care of myself and looking after my own interests and that kind of thing. And I mean, that's why you see it the worst in a corporate environment, because it takes all of those kind of selfish traits in it, like it supercharges them, and you have to do that in order to be successful in that environment.
They promote that in TV shows like The Apprentice. They actually show people backstabbing each other, and you know, it's become an entertainment for them. Mm. You know, it's an ideology that they actively promote. It's on a primetime TV. If you want to be successful, this is how you have to be.
Absolutely. I think it's this false confidence culture. Like, you know, you have to put your chest out and, you know, and step on your opponents and this kind of things. It's definitely something which permeates to the rest of society. From my experience, it has been. I mean, you guys are concurring, and definitely in comparison with other cultures. I think this is definitely something that the West should pay attention to. Let's go to the next slide, Karl Marx. Karl Marx, obviously, very important person. We're going to be covering him in more depth. But he actually has some things to say about individualism. Obviously, he is the father of one of the most collectivist ideologies, which is communism, or Marxism, really. He's written the Communist Manifesto. He's written many different books. And this is what he has to say on the issue. He says, the human being is in the most literal sense a political animal. Not merely a gregarious animal, but an animal which can individuate itself only in the midst of society. Now, individuation, be careful, and this word is a key word. Individuation is a word used in psychology, and people equivocate it with this term. So individuation is used by Carl Jung. And when he refers to the word, it's like the word ontology or deontology. It's one of those words that, depending on what subject matter you're talking about, we're talking about completely different things. When Jung or a psychoanalyst like him refer to individuation. They're talking about when someone moves away from the family looking after them and they start to discover themselves and they basically start to grow up. And it's just a process of individuation. It seems a very positive thing and it's a necessary part of the development of a human being. This is not what's being referred to here. This is individuation here. Is by Marx, it's a different idea altogether. So beware, if you read the word individuation in psychological literature, it's different to reading it in politically philosophical literature. Anyway, that's just an important point here. Production by an isolated individual outside society, a rare exception which may occur when a civilized person in whom the social forces are already dynamically present is cast by accident into the wilderness, is as much an absurdity as is the development of language without individuals living together and talking to each other. It's a very strong point. He's saying that the assumption of being able to do anything alone is absurd, just as the assumption of being able to develop a language by yourself is absurd. How can you develop a language? Language itself is impossible to be developed. I mean, if we talk about human language, the whole purpose of it is to communicate with other people, right? So the idea of having a language with one person, imagine there's one person in the world trying to create a language. It's a useless language because it cannot serve its function. So what Marx is saying is that this idea that you can individually, you can abstract the human being and isolate them from the rest of society is as useless as to consider that you can basically create a language with one person. It's as absurd as that. And the way he's, the force of the argument there, I think, is well felt. He continues, he says, man is not an abstract being squatting outside the world. Man is in the human world, the state, society. And this is goes back to the poem that the Sheikh was talking about, the Manzuma, when he talked about, if you can remember, do you remember the way he said the poem? Bring it out and then just tell me when you bring it. There was some abiyat that he was talking about in Fardaya, where he was talking about how can you do this alone, basically. You know, the Sheikh was mentioning the same kind of point as Marx is mentioning, you know. So this is important, okay? What do you think of that, before we move on to Edinburgh? What do you think of this particular criticism? Any comments on that? Any pushback on that, in fact? What do you think an individualist would say back to Marx? Let's try and challenge ourselves a little bit here. What would an individualist reply to Marx? Have you got a poem? Yeah, go on. Tell us the poem.
وعجب لهم من أين يأكلون ويشربون الماء وينكحون وهل على السفين يركبون وهل هم لذاك يصنعون.
So try and translate that for us, please.
وعجب لهم من أين يأكلون. So where does the individualist get his food from? ويشربون الماء وينكحون. And how does he himself drink water or get married? And
yeah, marriage would be meaningless
by himself,
right?
Meaningless by himself, exactly.
Yeah. And nowadays they're marrying themselves, I guess. I saw something on the newspaper, but this is nonsense, right? Yeah, keep going.
وَهَلْ عَلَى السَّفِينِ يَرْكَبُونَ. Travelling on boats. وَهَلْ هُمُ لِذَاكِ يَصْنَعُونَ. Making the boat itself.
Right. So all these industries, yeah. It requires teamwork. And so in order for them to have a functional society, you have to have collectives of some sort. Otherwise, the site will not be functional. Any point on what Marx said?
So could you say something like it's impossible to be an individual without a society because you can't manifest certain things like marriage?
So Marx would say, he wouldn't put it in that language. Marx would say that an individual understood by themselves, basically that the individual cannot be understood by themselves. They cannot be abstracted from their interdependent environment. They're interdependent by nature. They can't just be abstracted. When you abstract an individual by themselves, you have a meaningless notion almost. You can't analyze society like that. So he's attacking methodological individualism, not just ethical individualism, you know?
He admits that one can individuate himself or herself within society, right? So wouldn't an individual say that is what we mean by individualism? Not like...
No, they wouldn't say this. This is what psychoanalysts would say. Like, remember, individuation here is, in the psychological terms, meaning development and, you know, coming out of the protective cocoon of your parents and your father and your mother, and you becoming your own self. And this is not what's referred to as individuation in this type of literature. Now, Edmund Burke had very interesting. Edmund Burke, this is a very important name. In fact, he's one of the conservative fathers of conservatism. Okay, conservatism is an ideology which is worth studying, which is not on our list because it's not, you know, really neoconservatism is a form of liberalism. Okay, it's one permutation of liberalism, but conservatism as a whole, like the Tories, the Conservative Party and stuff, they actually have their roots back to a person like Edmund Burke. So Edmund Burke is an important name. He states in this regard, if everyone is self-interested, then that will crumble. That society will be crumbled away, and be disconnected into the dust and powder of individuality. Look at the strong expressions there. He says it will be an unsocial, uncivil, unconnected chaos of elementary principles, such that a theory of individual rights is to pave the way for anarchy. Now, obviously, here he's not saying that in a positive sense. But he has something to say about anarchy as well. Basically, he says, if you have anarchy, this is his criticism, if you have an anarchical system, then this actually creates tyranny. His idea is that because in an anarchical system, the most powerful, it's the survival of the fittest. If there's something called social Darwinism, which was obviously not related directly to this, but a man called Herbert Spencer, he developed the ideas of what he referred to as social Darwinism. But if you, going back to Hobbes, if you remember Hobbes, it seems to me like Edmund Burke has a very similar conception of the state of nature as Thomas Hobbes. And he's basically saying that if you have a society where it's anarchical, then you're going to have the rule of the strongest. You know, you're going to have the strongest people that will take advantage of that situation. So he's saying that, because remember, he's talking about the French Revolution at this point, which happened in the late 18th century. And and obviously the revolutionists were against the Catholic Church, naturally, right? But he was saying that the Catholic Church acts as a buffer between the individuals and the government. So in fact, if you have groups, this is his argument, and if you think about it, it's actually quite a powerful argument, right? He's saying if you have groups which are not governmental, like the Catholic Church, for example, right? Or you have other groups, yeah? Which are not strictly the government. If you have groups, these groups act as a buffer between the people and the government, such that the government cannot be tyrannical in as much the same way as they would be able to otherwise in a, say, an anarchical system. Or if not the government, it would be the most powerful. They would not be able to do the same thing because you have that which checks them. Does that make sense? So his argument is, if you just have an anarchical system, you're going to have the strongest rule. The strongest ones are going to rule. And so, in an ironic way, he would argue, you'd have authoritarianism. You see the irony there, because you're trying to get rid of it, but you're creating it by getting rid of it. Do you see the irony there, right? So, he continues and says that, so these intermediary groups act as a buffer against despotism. Let's discuss this actually for a little bit. We'll have a 5-minute break and let's talk about this. I should mention also that when I was talking about the spectrum, anarchism would be more on the left. Obviously, it's left wing, it's far left, right? Then I mentioned far right, but that was not in the political sense. But obviously, if we talk about the political spectrum, anarchism would be on the far left. Question is, to what extent, this is my question, to what extent do you think Edmund Burke's criticism of individualistic anarchism is correct? The criticism that says if you have an anarchical system, then that would itself create despotism, that would itself create an authoritarian system because you have the survivors of the strongest, you don't have these other groups which will be able to pull the reins of, you know, the that particular strong or collection of strong actors. And by the way, just to add, this can be politically strong actors, i.e. through the military actually having weapons and so on. Or it can be economically strong actors. So in economics, you phrase it as oligarchies or monopolies. So think about that 5 minutes and we'll come back here. let's see. What do you think? Do you think what he's saying makes sense, or do you think it does not make sense? Or to what extent do you think it makes sense?
So his point about having a non-governmental figure that would kind of be a buffer to despotism, I would say that's kind of an assumption that he's made there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that necessarily won't be true, because you can have, and it's happened in the past, where you have the government working together side by side with, for example, like the church.
No, but bear in mind, are you talking about the government and the church? You're right, okay, yeah, go on.
Yeah. So, in this example, even though a person, he's expecting that the church would act as a buffer towards that despotism, when in actuality they could actually be the ones to be in absolute power.
So it can be used against him. You can say that actually that's assuming that they have an intention to check the government, and that they're not being checked by the government, or that they're not being told by the government what to do in the first place. They're not puppets of the government, and that's absolutely true. That's correct, because we do see religious institutions acting as puppets for the government. That's very... There are assumptions that have to be made either way. Yeah, go ahead.
Sometimes this government's working for this kind of like church, or for instance, in a country like Spain, back in the years, the dictator was working for the church, or was part of the church.
Yeah, Catholic Church. Catholic Church. Illustrious history. Yeah. Obviously, it was one of the, if not, it was the most powerful, organization. So definitely, you could, and that's why, one of the reasons why it broke down, actually, well, it led to the Protestant Reformation. People didn't want to give their money to this institution that was, some kings, one tenth of the earnings or whatever it was.
Some kings, back in the Middle Ages, were there because of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they had no power other than the church or the Pope at the time.
Well, you know the history of this country, right? You know, with King Henry. I'm sure most of you have the VIII, and the separation and the divorces and all these kind of things, and how a lot of that was because of these kinds of tensions that existed between the church and the state, and why should we have another, this kind of outside church coming into our country and telling us what to do, and us giving them money, for what? We can just establish our own thing. And obviously Protestantism fit like a hand in a glove to that. And in fact, this is a very important, if you haven't studied it, an important part of history which you should know about, which is the Protestant Reformation, which is spearheaded by Martin Luther, not Martin Luther King, we're not talking about the 1960s, Martin Luther, the 1600s, yes, and this was one of his main arguments. Look at the corruption of the church, he said, look at the corruption, and why should we give them a tenth of our income, and so on and so forth. And obviously some kings found this very attractive, King Henry being one of them. Obviously, as we know, after King Henry VIII, there were other kings who rejected what he has to say, including his successors. James, a very important one, who went back to the Catholic Church, went back and forth,
What opinion? I think the good reforms, for the time, they were really good.
Who?
The Protestants, yeah.
The Catholic Church?
No, the new reforms by Luther.
Well, everyone had their agenda. This is my opinion. He had his agenda, and the Catholic Church had their agenda, And his agenda fit many of the Western European countries' agenda, which is why you had 30 Years' War, which is probably, one of the most deadly and bloody wars that has ever taken place in human history. I'm not sure if you know this war. And a lot of it was actually predicated on the. They talk to a Sunni Shia, There's never been a Sunni Shia equivalent to the 30 Years' War, ever, ever. The big Sufin and Jemal and all this. How many people died? 300, 500, 1,000, 2,000? Go and research the 30 Years' War, 100 Years' War, all these wars that took place after the Protestant Reformations and because of these tensions that took place. And a lot of it, like you mentioned, is because of the Catholic Church. And the feeling of corruption in the Catholic Church, there was a feeling. Whether that was a correct feeling or not is up for debate. No problem, you can have that debate. But it was definitely a feeling. And this led to the collapse of that church.
I think the same thing applies when we talk about that. The same thing would apply. And he says anarchy will lead to a real want of leadership. Same thing can apply, as we just discussed now. Totalitarianism or a tyranny could lead to a real want of freedom. Or
absolutely.
So I think it plays both ways. So I need something in the middle. Yeah.
No, that's a real good point. It's, when you're in a state where you're under authoritarian regime, that's why it's, you have the rise and fall of great empire. You know, books written, Richard named the rise and fall of great empire, and this is one of the reasons why empires actually fall. It happens not always because of an outside force coming in. You know, Ibn Khaldun, he has a book called Muqaddimah. And in his book, he actually tells us why there's rise and falls of empires. He mentions one of the reasons where people get too lavish. It could be authoritarianism, it could be this, it could be that. And then there needs to be a revitalization of the kind of community spirit. Sometimes that happens through revolution. We saw that in Islamic history, the Abbasids over the Umayyads. Obviously, they had their own kind of claims to lineage and whatever. But it was a revolution. It was a khuruj. You know, it was an absolute revolution. Khuruj al-Hakim. You know, I know some madkhalites might not like this kind of terms, but, you know, but this is the reality of the situation. So, like you said, it's the feeling of, okay, well, you want to take control of us? We're going to revolt. You know, so Marx and Lenin, obviously Leninism, which happened, as you guys know, you know, in the early 20th century, they're talking about 1917, 1919. You know, Lenin, Vladimir Lenin, you know, who basically led what you call a vanguard, revolutionary vanguard. You know, this was probably the biggest and most important vanguard that's taken place in the last 100 years, because it actually shaped what would be referred to as, you know, the Cold War thereafter, a bipolar system of governance. You had, you know, the Russian, no, the Soviet Union, and then, you know, but how did that start? It started with this revolutionary vanguard. Right? Why? Because of the feeling of authoritarianism. So on the point, though, let's go back to the point. The question of whether or not there will be perpetual conflict. Whether or not there will be perpetual conflict. In international relations, and you're studying this, it depends. By the way, I don't want to go into a tangent, but there are schools of thought in international relations. Yeah, for example, the two major ones that are being discussed in the books of international relations are what you call the realist school. They're called the realist school and the liberal school. Okay. You can look into those. There's defenders on both sides. But the idea is that in a situation where there are people fighting each other, or countries fighting each other, how do you achieve the maximum level of stability? So the liberal system says, well, it's cosmopolitanism. You know, you can do it through treaties and UN and all these kind of things. But in reality, you have one superpower, which in this case is the United States of America, which makes it look like there's some kind of discussions going on. But they are in control, fully in control. I mean, look at the proportion of seats that they have, in power they have, disproportionate level of power they have in the UN, for example, compared to other nations, even big nations like Russia and China. You know, they have disproportionate, it is a superpower nation. And this is referred to, by the way, as Pax Americana. We are living in an age which international relations specialists refer to as Pax Americana. Why do they call it as Pax Americana? Because it's a time where, because you have a superpower, the idea is that the other nations are not going to fight each other, because these guys have got nuclear warheads. They'll finish you if you try it with them. You know, it's like having, but it's basically the pecking order. It is a pecking order. This term, the pecking order, came from birds pecking and which ones are the top and so on. This, you have a pecking order, and you have America at the top of the pecking order. People are going to respect that, whether you like it or not, because they're not going to want to fight with someone with nuclear warheads and that can finish you, and Hiroshima, Nagasaki can end you and do what they do, even though they've lost wars now in Vietnam, humiliation, Afghanistan. But still, they have nuclear warheads. Still, they are the United States of America, 13 times more spending goes into their military than the next 10 countries combined. Can you imagine? Just think about that for a second. 13 times more military spending than the next 10 countries combined. So this is a serious superpower. And the reason why they call it Pax Americana is because they're not going to fight. You're not going to fight them because they're too big and too strong. But then the theory goes, this creates stability. It creates stability. Why? Because if there wasn't a big boss that was taking care of business, then everyone's going to fight each other. That's how the theory goes, right? Everyone's going to fight each other to establish who's the fittest, who's the strongest, who's the best, who should be in charge, who's the champion, if you like, who's the heavyweight champion. You know, that, so there will be like more. And so, what are the two verses in the Quran that was? Okay, shall I recite it for you? I mean, let me give it to you and tell you what it is. And the Quran actually alludes to these kinds of issues, yeah. And in Surah Al-Baqarah. And this shows you, like, the Quran, everything goes back to Quran and Sunnah. Everything is مَا فَرَّطْنَا فِي الْكِتَابِ مِنْ شَيْءٍ, as like everything has been mentioned in the Quran and Sunnah, right? Goliath, the story of David and Goliath. وَلَوْلَا دَفْعَ اللَّهِ النَّاسَ بَعْضَهُمْ بِبَعْضٍ لَفَسَدَتِ الْأَرْضُ وَلَكِنَّ اللَّهَ ذُو فَضْلٍ عَلَى الْعَالَمِينَ. That, and did not Allah check one set of people by means of another, the earth would indeed be full of mischief. But Allah is full of bounty to all the worlds. This happened when David beat the Goliath. Okay, so the idea is, if sometimes war is a requirement for peace. You know, it's a necessary evil for it. And so, this on this point, the idea of establishing dominance in a hierarchy is very clearly mentioned. The other verse, لَهُدِّمَتْ صَوَامِعُ كَثِيرٌ وَبِيَعٌ مَسَاجِرُ يُذْكَرُ فِيهَا اسْمُ اللَّهِ, you know, that there would have been destruction of the synagogues and the churches and masjids, if this, which by the way is a good verse to show that, you know, the Islam doesn't encourage destruction of these buildings, because why is it mentioning it as, you know, inferred negative, you know, that these if it hadn't been that there's, like, you know, some thing that was in charge there, or that if there was no checks put on people, that this would, you'd have people not being able to practice their religion, basically, whether it's Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, for example. And so the point is, Edmund Burke makes a good point, but I would say this: in order for his point to be correct, we must ensure that people are of equal strength. Like, we don't know, like, imagine you have a society with five people. One of them is already, I don't know, you have one adult and four children. The hierarchy is already set. You have one adult and four children, the hierarchy is already set. The children are going to obey the adult, and if not, the adult knows what to do. He'll physically discipline them or something, yeah? And the same thing can be said of nations, the same thing can be said of, you know, whatever it is. But what if you have five strong, equally strengthed adults? Then what Edmund Burke is talking about, or in fact this whole idea of perpetual conflict, is more likely. Because how are you going to establish hierarchy without fight? And I think that it does make sense, but in order for us to know which is more beneficial, we'd have to know the variables. Now, the next slide is quite controversial. Let's deal with it. These terrorists, who obviously we have to put a disclaimer, they're doing monstrous acts, we don't agree with it, blah, 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 right? Come on, I feel like if this is like, it's almost, we have to, we have to do this all the time, right? And if people are aware of our content, they'd know that, you know, they'd know where we stand on the issues. But a terrorist, like, say, for example, somebody who goes and blows themselves up, and he doesn't care about anyone else, you know, or he kill, or somebody else who kills this person or that person, whatever, you know, stabs somebody, or, they are individualist in one way. They are anarchists in that sense, because they don't care about the law. I mean, they are actually acting completely not caring about the consequences of the law. That's the statement I'm making. To what extent do you think this point can be made? Right, yeah, so that's the counter, right? So I was going to say, well, just think about it for a second, right? Give it 2-3 minutes, speak to the person next to you. And to what extent can someone make these kinds of arguments? Can someone say, well, a terrorist, someone who's killing an innocent or something like that, is acting from individual self-interest, or at least that they care not about the collective good so much that they would be willing to do something like that? To what extent is this a reasonable statement to make? That's 3 minutes and we'll come back, yeah? No. Do you want to start us up?
I say it's totally opposite. I would argue that they are... They either work for someone, or they follow someone, or they are brainwashed for, by someone.
Yeah, you could definitely make the argument that there's always going to be a hierarchy there, that there's some groups that are... So it's not... You don't care about the law, but you care about the laws of your group.
What they will think, or do it, for a collective higher purpose.
Yeah, but would that be a collective purpose? Higher purpose, yes.
Yeah, but they wouldn't do it... Like, normally, they wouldn't do it for themselves. If they, if the Islamic terrorists, or the so-called Islamic terrorists, yeah, they would, like Daesh, they would say, we're doing for our Islamic caliphate.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, so absolutely. But you do find Islamic terrorists, Muslim terrorists, whatever, they don't subscribe to ISIS, per se. They have other groups that they, you know...
Terrorists, just to like mention, there's Christian terrorists as well.
Yeah, we know that. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so they will also, yeah, they will also say like, oh, because we wanna create our Christian like KKK, yeah, like always,
yeah,
clean, racial, you know, Christian society.
Absolutely, absolutely. Any other points?
Yeah, kind of similar to what you were saying, where here the individual, so the terrorist, they actually think that the collective would benefit from another ideology, for example, and so they're actually doing it for the collective interest. And maybe another evidence for this is the fact that they're in instances willing to sacrifice their own lives, so their own individual life, their own individual interest, for this sake. But then one kind of critique that we mentioned that someone could make against this is the fact that they're actually doing it for kind of a future interest, which is the hereafter. So because they want to, you know, be in heaven and, you know...
Right. So that could be going back to egoism, right, in a sense?
Yeah, so in this sense, like, they are actually doing it for an individual reason.
That's actually a good, really good point. So it could be psychological egoism. They don't actually care about the collective interest. Maybe they don't care about... So it goes back to their intentions, what they're doing it for, you know. Are they doing it because they're trying to fulfill some collective project, or are they doing it genuinely because they think, this is going to be best for me? But I think both arguments are actually fine arguments, and you can make both of them. But it would go back to these particulars, right? Let's go to the next slide. Any other points?
In the argument?
Yeah.
Why would you kill someone?
What would you reply to that?
So what?
He said, why would you have to kill someone if you're a terrorist, in that argument that you made?
Why would you have to kill someone? I mean, it just depends on their ideology, right? Like, they might think that them killing someone is actually something which is legislated, you know, by, I guess, their religious belief. So they think that me, you know, kind of getting revenge, or me eliminating a threat, is necessary in this instance.
What do you want to say? Okay, good point. Yeah, right. So if you say a threat to whom? So if he's gone back to a collective discourse, yeah, right? If you say a threat.
He's making a statement.
What?
Like, sometimes, like, I'm not, obviously I'm not, but
yeah, yeah.
If I was to put myself in the mind of someone who's going to do that for a second, like, the objective could simply be like to make a statement.
Well, because you believe that person's life is worth taking, or that they should be out of the world. But once again, if you start saying that, then you can easily say, well, if you want him out of the world, then...
On a basic level, like, if you believe that, okay, me doing this is the easiest way for me to get to, for example, paradise, or however many...
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Enjoyment or whatever afterwards, then...
Yeah, yeah. If that's the only reason why you're doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for some people, it is, like...
Right, and maybe. We have to go and ask them and see what they're doing it for. we can't bring them back now. Yes, it's finished. Can't bring them. But, you know, you see, I think both of them, there's very good points. Threat to whom? That was a good question, a very good question. Because the question is, it implies that there's a collective there that still needs to be kind of looked at. All right. Now, let's look at D. Tocqueville, who wrote Democracy in America. He's a very famous liberal writer. And interestingly, despite his background, and obviously one of the main proponents of democracy, he actually has some harsh things to say about individualism. So he says, individualism is a calm and considered feeling which disposes each citizen to isolate himself from the mass of his fellows and withdraw into the circle of family and friends. With this little society formed to his taste, he gladly leaves the greater society to look after itself. He says, egoism is differentiated from individualism only in the fact that the latter, in this case individualism, is based on misguided judgment and inadequate understanding, rather than like depravity or something, yeah? And so he says, basically that individualism becomes egoism over time. We talked about egoism. Tocqueville is saying that individualism just becomes a form of egoism. You do what you want, like, you know, you're worshipping yourself, putting in Islamic parlance. He says, and this is what we're going to kind of end with today. He's got a very long quote, but I thought it would be worth reading it out and discussing it, okay? He states the following. It says, I want to imagine under what new features despotism could present itself to the world. I see an innumerable crowd of similar and equal men who spin around restlessly in order to gain small and vulgar pleasures with which they fill their souls. Each of them, withdrawn apart, is like a stranger to the destiny of all the others. His children and his particular friends form for him the entire human species. As for the remainder of his fellow citizens, he is next to them, but he does not see them. Kind of reminds me of the train discussion that we had in the beginning. He touches them without feeling them. He exists only in himself and for himself alone. And if he has a family, you can say that at least he no longer has a country. Part two, he says, above those men arises an immense and tutelary power, like from tutelage, you know, tutelary power that alone takes charge of assuring their enjoyment and of looking after their fate. It is absolute, detailed, regular, far-sighted and mild. It would resemble paternal power if, like it, had as a goal to prepare men for manhood. But on the contrary, he states, it seeks only to fix them irrevocably in childhood. It likes the citizens to enjoy themselves, provided that they think only about enjoying themselves. It's like egoism, right? It works willingly for their happiness, but it wants to be the unique agent for it and the sole arbiter. It attends to their security, provides for their needs, facilitates their pleasures, conducts their principal affairs, directs their industry, settles their estates, divides their inheritance. How could it not remove entirely from them the trouble to think that and the difficulty of living? He continues. This is how it makes the use of free will less useful and rarer every day. How it encloses the action of the will within a smaller space, and little by little steals from each citizen even the use of himself. Equality has prepared men for all these things. It has disposed men to bear them, and often even to regard them as a benefit. After having thus taken each individual one by one into its powerful hands, and having molded him as it pleases, the sovereign power extends its arm over the entire society. It covers the surface of society with a network of small, complicated, minute, and uniform rules, which the most original minds and the most vigorous souls cannot break through to go beyond the crowd. It does not break wills, but it softens them, bends them, and directs them. It rarely forces action, but it constantly opposes your acting. It does not destroy, it prevents birth. It does not tyrannize, it hinders, it represses. It enervates, it extinguishes, it stupefies. And finally, it reduces each nation to being nothing more than a flock of timid and industrious animals, of which government is the shepherd. Now, what Tocqueville is saying is that when you have individualism, which then turns into kind of like an egoism or an atomism of some sorts, this provides the most sophisticated type of tyranny, because it allows each person to instantiate their very independent will, and it customizes tyranny, if you want to put it that way. it's a very sophisticated type of control. You know, if you go to some of the nations which are dictatorial, they have a very hardcore approach. You talk about the government, you talk about the president, we'll put you in prison. You know, you do this, we'll put you. It's a very if then kind of situation, if statements, and if you do this, you. But here, Tocqueville, maybe if he was alive, he would say that the kind of tyranny that is applicable in the West, or even in parts of the East, like in China or in other places, is very sophisticated and customized. You get their details, where they're traveling, what they're going. So, you know, let's follow them, let's see what they're doing, and let's tyrannize them according to what their likes are, what their dislikes are, what their pleasures are. We know who they love. The tyranny is customized. We see in Guantanamo Bay, they bring the voices of your daughter or something in the, or that you'll see it in economy. They'll tyrannize you economically by manipulating what you're exposed to, you know, whatever it may be. That the tyranny is specific. And Tocqueville is saying that individualism can facilitate for the most encroaching type of tyranny. In fact, now we can discuss this, but we'll do so in our own time. We've already taken up a lot of yours, but hopefully this has acted as some kind of a springboard for some of your own thoughts on the issue, and hopefully we can see you next time. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.